The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and for commenting. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking to Professor John Flannery, who is pioneering a technique called optogenetics in a quest to cure blindness. Really, really exciting and interesting science. We'll be chatting to him in a few minutes' time. But as always, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me to kick off the show are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan. You're very welcome, guys. Our first story. Oh, happy day. I suppose one of the first good stories I've seen in a while on the development of these vaccines, Lara, they've been sort of stopping and starting, but the Oxford vaccine seems to work on all ages. That's a good sign.
Yeah, it's just fantastic news, to be honest. So I suppose everyone's eagerly awaiting the production of this vaccine. In reality, there's actually a lot of different vaccines going on. There's 11 that are already in phase three, and there's 6 that are approved for very limited use. But the two front runners, as most people in the scientific community would see it, are the AstraZeneca/Oxford vaccine and then the Pfizer vaccine that's working with a German company called BioNTech. So they haven't released, either company haven't released the official scientific data. They want to release it in peer-reviewed journals. But what they have said at a scientific meeting, the Oxford team have said, is that it looks like there's good efficacy and good immune responses in people over the age of 50 and also over the age of 70, which is fantastic news. For people who don't know, one of the reasons why elderly people are hit harder by vaccine or by viruses such as COVID-19 is because they have, I suppose, a weakened immune system. Over time, our immune system can't hold out the same way it can when we're younger. And that is a problem, obviously, because people can get worse infections, but it's also a problem because it means you can't mount an immune response to a vaccine. So it's been one of the big worries about whether or not elderly people would actually even be able to mount a response to this vaccine and whether it would do anything in them at all. Because if you can't vaccinate an elderly person, then we still have to keep going with everything else, social distancing, hand washing. And it looks like there is a good response, which is fantastic news. They look like they produced the same sort of antibodies as the younger volunteers did. Now, they haven't officially released all this data yet, but from what they've said at this closed scientific meeting, so far it looks really, really good. They're saying that they may have vaccines ready before the end of this year. I don't think that they'll be mass vaccinating before 2020 is over, yeah. But they have the capacity to make 3 billion vaccines, which is, they will have to give 2 doses of their vaccine. So that would vaccinate 1.5 billion people around the world. I personally don't know if the first few vaccines are going to be the vaccines that save us all, but if anything else, they might cause people to have less severe disease. Less severe disease, and they might keep people out of hospital and keep people alive. So it's good news all around, really.
One of the worries, of course, of there not being enough of a vaccine for everybody is that we might see this stratification globally where the richest countries get access first and the poorer countries and poor parts of those societies more vulnerable. Not the elderly, but perhaps poor socioeconomic groups, they may end up waiting longer than anyone else.
Oh, absolutely, Jonathan. And I think it's a sad truth that probably the European community, all 750 million of us, will likely get the vaccine before people who potentially need it far more than us. So it's something that really needs to be looked into, fairness and equity about handing out this vaccine.
Even within our own countries, we know that COVID disproportionately affects certain groups, and it's socioeconomically dependent.
Yeah, and that's seen across the world, actually. Shane, our second story has to do with mobile phones.
Yeah, so when you're watching TV at home, do you scroll on your mobile?
It depends on what it is. If it's the boys, which I'm watching at the moment, absolutely not. If it's the kids, where they make me watch stuff that I'm not as interested in, I might sit at the back and scroll through, yes.
So this media multitasking is quite common, particularly common for people in the 18 to 26 year old bracket. And researchers in Stanford have looked at how that media multitasking can affect your memory. So they did a test. They took 80 people in that age bracket who self-reported their level of media multitasking, and they looked at their performance in a memory test. So what they did was they showed them images of objects on a computer and asked them if they'd seen it earlier. And while they were doing that, they'd monitored their eye tracking and their EEG, which is like electrical signals in the brain. So basically these monitoring tools were there to monitor attentiveness. And they found that people who had self-reported a lot of media multitasking, they weren't really able to pay attention as well as those who had a lower self-reported multimedia multitasking. So basically that idea of getting distracted by your phone can impair your ability to remember things. It sounds very obvious. Like, I've certainly sat through television programs and, you know, my fiance would say, you know, what do you think? And I'm like, oh, actually, I've missed the last 10 minutes of that, even though I thought I was watching it.
Yeah. I've done the same with my wife's conversations. In defense, she has also done the same. We find ourselves quite a lot, and this is awful, but if it's sort of, you sort of got the gist of what they're saying, you find yourself going, mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're looking at something on your phone, and then you look up and your husband or wife, we're both equally guilty of this, will be going, what the hell? This is my future we're talking about, or whatever.
You know, like I find myself doing this with Zoom meetings as well. So yeah. Like it's I find it very hard to kind of pay attention.
So what I do, Shane, I train people, as you know, on communicating ideas and so on. That's my day job. And what I try and do is at the beginning of a virtual meeting, I say, put the phone away in another room, if you don't mind, while we're doing this training, because it's actually really useful for you. You've paid good money for it. Let's just get engaged and stay with it. And it's a much better way of starting a meeting, because if you have the phone there, I mean, it's hard to compete over, you know, maybe a 2-hour session to keep people's interest going over and over.
So it sure is. And in teacher education, we sometimes say to our student teachers, you know, if the pupils you're working with are chatting to each other or they're bored, maybe you're being boring.
Yeah.
So
indeed. Our third story, I know what you're trying to imply there. I'm just skipping over, Shane. Our third story has to do with vampire bats and social distancing, Lara.
Absolutely. So for the day that's in it, and happy Halloween to everybody, we have a lovely story about vampire bats. So these are not vampire bats in Transylvania. They're actually in Belize, which is a country in Central America. And the Ohio State University, the team who study those vampire bats there, have seen before that when a vampire bat in captivity is unwell, they will social distance from the rest of their vampire bat friends. And they wanted to see, look, is this just a thing that happens in captivity, or is this something that happens in the wild? So they went out and they found a group of 31 vampire bats, and they took 15 of them, and they injected them with what a thing we call lipopolysaccharide. It's a part of a bacteria that causes your immune system to respond and think you're sick, but it doesn't actually make you sick to just get it. Hmm. And then they injected the other half with just a placebo, which was just saline, salty water. And then they re-released them. And what they did was, just before they released them, they stuck a little tiny tracker onto them to see where they would go and where they would sit or hang in relation to their other bat pals. And very interestingly, they found that the ones who had gotten the LPS, so thought that they had an infection, thought that they were sick. Now, just to note, they did not make these poor bats sick, but they thought that they were sick.
Yeah.
They found that they interacted less. They interacted with 4 less other vampire bats and spent 25 minutes less in a 6-hour period close to other vampire bats. So it's just fascinating to see that animals in the wild, especially intelligent animals like bats, are actually able to presumably sense that they are unwell. And as a result, they will choose to stay further away and hopefully reduce the risk of spreading whatever disease they have.
Did they control for the fact that when you're sick or think you're sick, you move less anyway, you feel unwell, or did they not feel unwell?
No, they did feel unwell. Definitely. Right. Well, I mean, look, who knows how a bat feels, but I mean, they were given something that would make anyone feel unwell. If you got an injection of LPS or I got it, you would feel rotten. You know, it really is a horrible, it really activates the immune system. You'd feel absolutely rotten. But they had to allow these animals to fly back to where they would have been. So they have to, the animals then have to choose where they roost. And they still found that they moved. Right. The animals were still moving around, but they just weren't getting as close to their other bat friends. I actually don't know what the name is for a group of bats, so I've been sort of skirting over the fact that I didn't have that word for this whole story, but I have to admit it now, I don't know what a group of bats is called. But they stayed away from the main cohort of the group of bats. Yeah, and it's not just because they weren't able to move around, they were able to move around.
It's a camp of bats.
Yeah, how did you not know that? Everyone knows that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, sorry. Obviously you weren't both sitting on Google as I was talking there.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with whale songs.
Yeah, so scientists from the Naval Information Warfare Center in the Pacific region of the US have looked at a whale swapping songs. So it was always thought that groups of male fin whales had only one tune. So each group had one tune, where they take two notes and they play them at different rhythms, and that's unique to their pod. But what these scientists have found is that when whales brush up against or migrate and they meet other pods of whales, that they can learn their tunes. And so what they did here was they took hydrophones, which are underwater microphones, they stuck them in the ocean off Hawaii. They recorded the songs of 115 whales over 6 years, and they were able to triangulate using multiple hydrophones which whale was singing what tune. And they found that whales often had more than one tune, and sometimes those tunes were associated with pods that lived in areas very, very far away in the Pacific Ocean. So they know now that they're able to learn other tunes. This is a very useful tool because it'll help those scientists understand the population dynamics of fin whales in the ocean. In other words, you know, how they move, how they migrate, how many of them are there.
Would humans be able to tell the difference between these songs, Shane?
Well, as I said, there are two notes with a variation in rhythm. So I think we would. A lot of the sounds that whales emit are subsonic, so our ears wouldn't be able to hear them. But these hydrophones would be able to sort of translate them into audio signals that we can hear. So we can hear things that vibrate from 20 times a second all the way up to 20,000 times a second if you're young and haven't damaged your hearing.
Wait, when you say the whale song is subsonic, is all whale song subsonic?
No, I think that some of it is in the audio range, but the vast majority of it is
yeah, because you see those natural history documentaries, and I'm wondering, did they just translate that for us, or would the human ear hear it? You're saying it would hear some of it.
Yeah, it would indeed. Of course, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, was all dependent on aliens hearing whale song from planet Earth. And when those whales, they were humpback whales, disappeared, those aliens came back to Earth wondering, where are these whale folk gone?
Okay, that's us. That's us for News Round. Well done, Shane. You really tanked it at the end there. Thanks to Lara Dungan, Dr. Shane Berger from UCD. We'll see you next week. Coming up, optogenetics and the search for a cure for blindness. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, you've heard of doctors having a God complex. Well, our next guest is trying his best to impersonate Jesus. He's trying to cure the blind. John Flannery is professor of neurobiology at the University of Berkeley and a member of the Medical and Scientific Advisory Board for Fighting Blindness Ireland. And he'll be speaking at Retina 2020, a conference that brings together international and Irish researchers and clinicians in the global effort to find treatments and cures for conditions that cause vision impairment and blindness. Welcome to the program, John. Tell me, that's a very Irish name, but you're in UC Berkeley. Tell me a little bit about your work and what your interests are.
Yeah, I've worked on retina, the back of the eye where the vision occurs, for my whole career, actually since I was an undergraduate in college. It's been a fascination, and so I worked on the normal way the retina works for many years, and then I got interested in how things go wrong and retinal diseases that patients have. And so over the decades, we've gotten to the point where we've tried to develop therapies for patients that have inherited blindness that runs in their family. It's genetic diseases.
How does that differ to treating blindness that is, I suppose, aggregated over time?
Actually, almost all the inherited blindnesses occur over time. The gene defect you have when you're born, and depending on what defect you inherit, it can manifest as a small child or sometimes not until you're a teenager, and in some conditions like macular degeneration, not till you're 50 or 60. So it kind of depends on which of the defects you inherit.
Right, but it's quite rare to be born blind. Why is that?
That's a great question. You know, my colleague Jennifer Doudna in my department won the Nobel Prize last week, and if I knew the answer to your question, I might be next in line.
So let's do some basic biology. How does the retina work?
Oh, that's an interesting question. There are some cells that are called rod and cone photoreceptor cells in the very back of your eye, and they take light and they convert it first to a chemical reaction, and then they convert that into an electrical signal, and that's relayed through a couple other nerve cells that don't respond to light, but they respond to this electricity, and then ultimately that goes through your optic nerve to your brain.
How well do we understand these electrical signals? Before we talk about curing blindness, I wanted to talk about synthesizing sight. Is it possible with the technology that we have to create a synthetic retina? Can we create signals, I suppose, sophisticated enough to get the eye to see something when there's no biological retina?
There have been some attempts to connect a video camera to the patient's brain and patients that are completely blind or to their optic nerve. That's been incredibly challenging because we know quite a bit about how the retina works, but we don't know much about how it encodes the signal. And the signal is encoded quite a bit to make it smaller and faster before it goes to the brain. And so you have to understand that. So that will be quite a while off before you have an electronic prosthetic, if you will. A colleague of mine, Jack Gallant, has been able to use a MRI scanner to look at the patterns in the brain of graduate students that are in the scanner when they look at something. But to your exact question, nobody, to my knowledge, has ever been able to interpret the signals coming out of the eye and understand what the image or the picture is.
Talk to me then about your research and some of the exciting things that are happening, because in the search to cure blindness, you first have to start with animal models. Tell me about your research.
Yeah, the best way to get started in trying to design a therapy for patients is to work with small animals, because we need to do lots of experiments, so we need lots of animals. So there's quite a few different strains of mice that have the same genetic defect as groups of patients that have retinitis pigmentosa or other eye diseases. So we start there. We try to do it in two ways. We try to understand exactly what went wrong that caused the mouse to go blind. And then we sort of work on that understanding to design a rational therapy. So in some therapies, if you know exactly what the patient's disease gene is, you might be able to just put back a normal copy of that disease gene. And there's a therapy that's currently available in the clinic from Spark Therapeutics and Roche that does exactly that. In a few patients, they have missing one gene defect, and the therapy is you give them that back by an injection in their eye. In my lab, we try to do many versions of that because there's over 300 different genes that can cause blindness. So we have lots of animal models, and we have several different therapies that we're testing.
Is this using your colleague Jennifer Doudna's technique, CRISPR?
We've been testing that. We have a collaboration with their lab. And for patients that have dominant diseases of the eye where they get one gene defect from one parent. The CRISPR will be great, but it's several years from being in the clinic. The treatments that are currently testing in patients are for recessive diseases where you get a defect from both of your parents and you're completely missing something. And so most of our work has been on these recessive conditions, which is about half the patients.
So this is where my understanding of genetics breaks down a little bit, because obviously with unborn fetuses, you can change things in the DNA potentially. And I understand how that would have an effect. But with an adult, how do you localize genetic information? How does the injection work?
That's a really good question. You know, currently, other than one sort of cowboy experiment in China where people use CRISPR to edit a fetus, there's been an embargo in most countries about doing any of that early intervention. Ultimately, maybe that's possible, but there's lots of concerns about doing harm, having something unexpected happen. There's lots of concerns about eugenics. So the progress in the field has been to use the shell of a virus, just the outside coat of a virus. And that's very timely, I guess, because everyone knows how incredibly efficient COVID-19 is. So we use a very different virus for the eye that's never been shown to cause any disease. We also only use the outside of it, so we cripple it so it can't make copies of itself. And instead of the normal gene that's in that virus, which we call AAV, adeno-associated virus, we put in a copy of the gene that the patient has a defect in. We put in a normal copy of that gene. So we use the virus shell, which is injected by the ophthalmologist into the patient's eye, to carry the DNA and protect it. And that virus will carry the DNA into the retina cells. And then that's a permanent one-time only repair.
But surely we have lots of retina cells and these are tiny things. I mean, are you just sort of spraying all the cells with this needle, or is it cell by cell? It just sounds like something that needs to be so targeted and so precise. And I'm just wondering does it matter if this virus infects cells that aren't retina cells?
Part of the gene that is put in the virus is sort of what you might think of the mailing address. In the States, you'd call it the zip code. It's the promoter. It regulates what cells will turn on the gene that it's ahead of and what cells won't and how much of a thing it makes and the timing. So that's included. It's called a regulatory element. So you can control what cells express your therapeutic gene.
Wow.
And then also to your question, it's a question of scale. A normal human has 150 million photoreceptors, which are the ones that are affected in these conditions. But the viruses are very much smaller than photoreceptor cells. So you can inject with a very, very small volume many, many hundreds of millions of virus particles. So typically there's more virus particles injected than there are cells in the retina.
And in mice, you've had blind, I'm thinking of the nursery wrong now, you've had these blind mice.
More than three.
Yeah, you've had them be able to, make out shadows or have a little bit of detail or have 20/20 vision?
Well, no mice have 20/20 vision.
Of course, yeah.
But what we did is we built some behavioral apparatus, if you will, to test whether the mice could see and what kind of vision they had. So basically, it's a 1 meter square white plexiglass box, and it sits on the lab bench in normal lighting, and it doesn't have a top, it just has a bottom and four sides. And we put some what we call novel objects. It could be a cube or a tennis ball or a hairbrush or something in there in the middle. And a completely blind mouse, if you put them in this box, they basically just move around the walls. They don't leave the walls. You can think of lots of anecdotes, but basically they're feeling their way around. They probably don't know there's any novel objects in the middle because they can't see, and they're hesitant to explore. So if you talk to people who are in the very late stages of blindness, that's similar to what you might do if you went to a new hotel room that you weren't familiar with. You would memorize the layout of the room by moving your hands along the wall, and you'd be very concerned about tripping over the coffee table. So in a normal mouse, if you put them in this box, they go around the walls, but they also explore all the objects quite quickly. You can imagine they're looking for food. In the untreated blind mice, nothing happened. I mean, they stay at the edge of the wall. But in the treated mice, what we see is they move around the box and explore the novel objects just as much and just as quickly as the normal mice. So
is that the best analog we have for understanding whether or not mice see things? I mean, do we not have the equivalent of an fMRI or other sort of visual tests? It seems quite crude.
We do, but we've done many mouse versions of what ophthalmologists will use in the clinic, but the behavior is actually the most telling.
Right.
And for severely blind patients, when I go to a meeting like the public engagement day that Fighting Blindness will have this Saturday, when you ask them what they want, a lot of what they want is motility, being able to get around their house.
Hmm.
So the behavioral screen, even though it's relatively low tech compared to measuring the electrical output or MRI, to our way of thinking, that's the best measure of what kind of vision recovery we're getting.
The cells that you're talking about, they're not damaged in a typical way, are they? Is that why you think this therapy might work? I'm thinking of muscles that atrophy from lack of use, and other cells that if they're not used, they die. With these retinal cells, it seems like even though they haven't been used, this replacement of the gene sort of switches them back on?
That's an excellent question. In a couple of the therapies that are currently in the clinic, the patients have to be treated as early as possible because exactly that, their photoreceptor cells, their Rosser cones are dying. But if you get to the point where the photoreceptor cells have died, there's no way to do a gene therapy because you can't put the gene back if the cell that the gene is in is gone. Mm. The therapy we're trying to develop, which is called optogenetics, is for patients in the very late stages of blindness when they have lost the rod and cone photoreceptor cells. And what we're doing is we're capitalizing on the knowledge that, as I said a few minutes ago, the photoreceptors talk to some other cells in the retina that are not light sensitive. They respond to electrical signals from photoreceptors. So our gene therapy is designed to add light sensitivity to the third cell in this chain between the damaged photoreceptors and the brain. And since it's in the middle, if you can make that cell, which is a relay cell, light sensitive, that's a new opportunity for restoring vision in the blind.
Wait, you're saying that you're trying to give a new property to a cell that isn't normally used to detect light?
Yes, we are targeting what's called the retinal ganglion cells. They're the third cell in the chain that goes photoreceptor, bipolar cell, then ganglion cell, then your brain. Our therapy is to add a new light receptive function to the ganglion cells, which in almost all patients are retained for decades after they've lost vision.
Is this using the same technique as injecting with the virus to swap out the DNA?
It is the same technique. It's using a virus. It's using a relatively simple intraocular injection. It capitalizes on a lot of the knowledge from ophthalmology treating patients for decades with the surgery. And it's a relatively straightforward surgery. Any ophthalmologist will be able to do it.
Wow. And what sort of excitement is there around this technology, John? Because what you've described obviously would be revolutionary in terms of blindness. And by the sounds of it, you're talking about a very quick procedure to essentially cure the blind.
So since those other cells that are not normally light sensitive can survive for decades after the patients are blind, it's particularly appealing because you could, in theory, could treat people at any age, any stage. And also it's appealing because unlike the other therapies where you have to identify the exact genetic defect in the patient and put that exact gene back, this is putting a light sensitive function back in a different cell. So it doesn't require you to know what the defect is in the patient. It's very timely to be talking to you today because this morning Novartis announced they acquired our small startup company. So Novartis now is partnering with us to bring this to the clinic.
Well, congratulations. I know that's enormous news for you and great validation, because having a company like Novartis endorse this procedure means that it will hopefully get to many, many patients. How far away are we from trying this in humans, or have we already done that?
Currently, we're making a clinical grade product that's applicable for use in patients, and we'll start testing that in small groups of patients. We have already tested in dog models of blindness and shown that it is safe.
What about the fact that these cells aren't optimized for this purpose? Are you hopeful that you'll get good resolution? Is it unclear as to how good these ganglion cells will be at performing a brand new task?
In some ways, it's not really a brand new task. Normally, their task is to convey the information from the photoreceptors to the patient's visual center in their brain. And they're still connected in exactly the right way to do that. And so we're not really changing their task. We're just making them respond to light instead of signals from photoreceptors. So we expect that a few weeks after the treatment, the patient should start to recover some vision.
John, there is an enormous amount of people on the planet that have an inherited blindness. This is a very exciting time for you, surely, because if this therapy works as well as it's done in animals, in humans, then you may literally have cured blindness.
The hope is for some patients, they'll get a significant increase in their vision. The amount of the drug that's injected in the eye is very, very small. So manufacturing enough of the treatment, the virus to treat lots of patients is not going to be that difficult.
Yeah, but I suppose my question was more human than that. Are you excited about this potential? Obviously, the acquisition by Novartis is hugely promising.
Yeah, it's exciting. Working with the Foundation Fighting Blindness in the States and in Fighting Blindness Ireland, I've met lots of people with very severe vision loss. And if I could help one of those, I would be very excited.
Well, John Flannery from University of Berkeley, California, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for your time.
That is pretty cool, isn't it? I mean, the idea that we may have a cure for blindness by hijacking cells in the eye that originally didn't see, that is some pretty cool science. I'd love to know your thoughts on that, particularly if you're affected by blindness or you know someone who is affected by vision impairment. If you want to find out more about that retina conference, it's retina.ie. There are tickets. Disclosure, I am speaking at the event about communicating science. So I am connected to this event, but that's not why we booked John. John was just excellent anyway. Aidan, how are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
You seem surprised that I was bringing you into the podcast. This is the time when we normally talk about texts and tweets, is it not?
Yeah, I normally just shut off I was just enjoying my surroundings, and I just thought that would go on for longer. So apologies.
I see. So you just drown my voice out with thoughts of just what, squirrels on a wall.
Well, just when you were talking, my head has gone. Da-da-da, hey,
excellent. That's wonderful. That's my producer, everybody. Listen, I know you sent me a link to the album. I literally haven't had a moment to listen to it, but I will do soon. Do you want to give it a quick plug?
I would love to give it a quick plug. Yeah, it's the album is called We Found Prester John by Prester John is the name of the artist. And I and many other Irish musicians featured on it. And I wrote the songs for it. So really proud of it. You can get it on all of the usual digital places. But you can get it on Bandcamp. Then the band gets a bit more money. Then
get it on
places.
Bandcamp. Do Bandcamp.
Yeah.
Because,
Or if you want a hard copy old school, you can email sciencenewstalk.com and we'll sort that out for you.
That's fine.
Hijacking.
Exactly what sort of cut am I going to get out of the sales? Aiden? Never mind.
What sort of commission?
Check it out. Prester John, P-R-E-S-T-E-R John. Search for it on Bandcamp or drop us an email if you like, as Aidan says. I thought we should give it a mention because people don't realize that you are a multi-talented person, both writing and songwriting, and also the producer of the greatest podcast that's ever been recorded. Moving on before I embarrass myself. We were talking last week about aneurysms and I kept on saying aneurysms. I don't know why, but did you fix that in the edit or did you leave me saying aneurysms?
God, it wasn't that noticeable for me. I should have underlaid an Enya song every time. Like Orinoco Flow every time.
Aneurysms, yeah. We asked you for your questions and someone says, I lost my dad to a ruptured aneurysm 13 years ago. It led to myself and my siblings having to be scanned as his brother and mother both died from ruptured aneurysms. Wow, that's quite scary, isn't it? His sister has two currently and so do I. They're very small and I'm having them scanned every few years. And that's from Caroline. Oh, that's a tough thing to live with, isn't it? And that sort of idea that, you know, something could happen and you don't know when is terrifying.
Absolutely. That the treatments, hopefully, you know, they can be brought along quickly. But I thought it was so interesting how sort of practical and visual the explanations of them were. Like they made such obvious sense. It was easy to visualize them, and hopefully, those treatments come along and our texts are kind of veiled of them.
There were a couple of texts that asked about medications and whether or not one might be a factor for something else and for medical. And also, I don't really know reasons. I'm afraid I can't answer those. So apologies for that. Lots of people enjoyed the geoforensics interview. Yeah, wasn't it just mad? If you didn't listen last week, we spoke to Matteo Barone, who is essentially a geologist who works for the Italian police, trying to find bodies in remote places using his geo super sense. And it has earned him like threats from the mafia and some really hardcore stuff. It was fascinating what he did.
He was so blasé about it as well, but yeah. He had a great attitude. Like he was just like, look, this is for justice. These people deserve justice. So I don't really worry about the fact that somebody's essentially threatening my life. More people like him, please.
Well, yeah. But also he was, you know, like if I said it, that would be, you know, I'd be given out to for, you know, stereotyping. But he kind of said, look, you know, if you're Italian, you sort of have to live with these sort of death threats from the mafia and dogs severed heads outside your car. So it was enlightening, to say the least. We also spoke to Marcus Hallgren about zombies, and that was the week before, so never mind. that's all. I guess we don't have a huge amount of texts and tweets this week. Do you want to fill some dead air, Aidan? I mean, I've got stuff to do, so, and I'm sure the people listening to this podcast also have already turned off. So, you know what? Don't waste your breath. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing on sound. Steve McLaren, Steve Dunn, Garrett Mulhall, and Simon Keane were researching. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. Don't miss the Fame Lab finals. They're on November 12th. Simon Spychak is Ireland's representative winner. You can see him in the semi-finals. More details on britishcouncil.ie/FameLab. See you soon. In the meantime, stay curious.